The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. This week, we're looking at food sustainability with researchers who study the social, economic, and technological aspects of global food production. And a little later, we'll speak to researcher and blogger Danielle N. Lee about a recent controversy in the science blogosphere. Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. I'm very pleased to have two guests with me today. Valentine Kedju is a researcher and lecturer in the departments of sociology and geography, society and environment at the University of Minnesota. She studies the cultural geography and social organization of land use and food governance, and the politics of environmental decision-making, particularly where urban and rural land uses intersect. Valentine has recently edited with Patrick Hurley a special issue of GeoJournal on amenity migration and exurban and rural land uses, and with Laura Taylor the book Landscape and the Ideology of Nature in Exurbia, Green Sprawl. Good to have you here, Valentine.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Emily Cassidy. Emily Cassidy has a Bachelor's of Science in Environmental Science and is currently a graduate research assistant with the Global Landscapes Initiative. On a larger scale, Emily is interested in how global diet preferences impact land use and environmental change. Her research has focused on global crop uses and how feed grains and grasses are converted into meat and dairy. And she's currently in the process of completing her master's degree in natural resources science and management in the College of Food Agriculture and Natural Resources Science. Emily's interdisciplinary thesis was published recently, and we'll be talking about this, and draws from nutrition, global food security, and environmental sciences. Thanks for being here, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so let's start this out really broadly. Our global population has recently passed 7 billion people, and there's a lot of concern about how we're going to put food in all those mouths. So when we're talking about the capacity and sustainability of our food supply, what exactly are we talking about? What factors are we looking at?
Being able to feed 7 billion people and by 2050, 9 billion people is going to be quite a challenge. And we're also finding that, you know, as people change their diets also, that's going to stress the food system. So when we talk about being able to meet agricultural demand, we not only have to think about how many people are on Earth, but also what kinds of diets they're consuming.
One of the things I've been really looking forward to discussing with Emily, too, is when we think about these narratives of feeding the world or the hungry billion, a lot of the people who are really hungry are people who are currently or were really recently food producers. So there's also a question of what kind of food is produced and how it gets to people or how it stays in circulation and communities to be able to be eaten. And I think especially from the Midwest where we're conducting this research, we often don't think about it that way.
Within that, we're also talking about things like energy and the environment, sort of how food production affects the environment, and technology, and so the type of food we eat, as you mentioned. And one thing that you were actually interested in is the cultural relationship with food, Valentine.
It's interesting. I've been listening as I prepare for my fall classes to various people's histories of food and agriculture. And we know that people have cultures of food. And we also know here in the heart of corn and soybean production that corn and soy is not going directly into food or into even the food cultures of the people who are eating in the midst of it. But I think that it's harder to see sometimes how thoroughly this idea that we feed people and that farmers are virtuous to the degree that they feed people ends up being very complicated by the competition for crops, whether they're going into energy or into other kinds of materials for industrial production. We haven't really updated our narrative of what farmers produce and why that's useful to society. So we kind of founder on this idea of food is the central value.
So this is not an easy conversation because we have a multitude of things to talk about and a multitude of factors that actually affect food sustainability. So maybe let's start with energy. That's as good a place as any. How does the U.S. compare to other countries in terms of energy use in food production?
That's a good question. I think that compared to, well, we're a very developed nation, but compared to other economies, we actually use a lot less energy per unit output than some other countries. China, for example, uses a lot of fertilizer and therefore energy to produce that fertilizer on their croplands. So with respect to how much energy that we're using, it's a lot, but I think in comparison to, say, what we're using to insulate our homes and for transportation, it's actually small in comparison, whereas in other countries, it's a lot larger.
There's an interesting point about energy intensity in terms of energy in to energy out in food. And here's where being on radio is killing me because I'm a point to graphics kind of person. But there's this wonderful graphic that shows calories in to calories out per country. And then also you can switch it up and it shows percentage of income used to meet daily caloric needs in all those countries. And it's a really telling shift. And I think one of the things it points to is that although it's true, Emily is absolutely right, that the U.S. is doing better and better in terms of yield for inputs. And I have to give credit here. I just came from a weekend-long agroecology summit that happens in Southwest Minnesota at the Thompson Farm every couple of years. And they were blowing me away with statistics on how much less inputs are required for ridge-till farming and how yield has increased since the 70s when they started to do this. That being said, the whole model of agriculture that we have and that has been propagated around the world and has, you know, very enthusiastically been picked up in places like China was really developed in the context of an energy-rich and labor-poor social context where we had not very many people for the amount of land that had been made possible to farm through various means, many nefarious. But the idea was you needed to be able to do as much as you could on that land. And this is one of the things that there's started to be a lot more awareness of, I think, in the last few years as people have rethought what the implications of the Green Revolution, this shift toward high input, high output systems has meant, both in terms of world food supply, but also for the farmers who are doing it.
Well, and I understand that eating meat is particularly energy intensive. Can you explain that?
A lot of meat production in the United States and also increasingly in other countries is grain fed. So we're feeding feed corn and soybeans and also other agricultural products like wheat and rice to animals. And so it requires a lot of those crops to produce meat and dairy. For example, when you feed 100 calories of corn to beef cattle, you're getting only 3% of those calories or 3 calories back in boneless beef. And so when we look at different kinds of meat and dairy, they're different levels of intensity. And in fact, this is especially concerning in the United States because we feed more corn to beef cattle than we do any other kind of livestock. And it happens to be the least efficient way to produce meat. So, you know, like Valentine was saying, when we talk about agriculture and sort of the return on energy investment or economic investment or environmental investment, we need to think about what we're getting back. How many people are actually feeding with the enormous amount of field corn that we're producing in the Midwest of the United States? And we're finding that it's not very many because of the fact that we're using most of that corn for animal feed and also increasingly to produce corn ethanol.
Now, you just actually finished some research, Emily, as to how we currently allocate our crops. Can you give us some background on that?
Sure. So I did a study with some colleagues here at the University of Minnesota looking at globally how we use all of the crops that we grow. Once we figure out how we're using the crops that we grow, we can translate that into how many people we're actually feeding. So what we find is that globally, 36% of all of the calories that we produce go to animals for feed. And we're losing most of those calories in the plant-animal conversion process. If we shifted crops away from their current mix of uses, not just being used for food, but also being used to animal feed and biofuels, if we shifted the crops used for animal feed and biofuels to food for human consumption, we could increase calorie availability by 70%. And that would be enough calories to feed an additional 4 billion people.
So if your main concern was environmental in regards to food sustainability, would a vegan diet be the best way to go?
Yeah, I mean, if you were only concerned about environment and you disregarded the social and economic aspects of agriculture, a diet that is mostly plant-based, not necessarily all vegan, but mostly plant-based, would be the environmental optimum. I guess you could say that if we caught animals in the wild and we ate them, that that would retain some environmental integrity.
Right.
But in general, yes, I think if you're just concerned about the environment, veganism would be the optimum.
And bugs and algae. I know it sounds weird, but the archaeological record suggests that for most of human history, we ate a lot more invertebrates than we currently do. And presumably, there are still food cultures that know what to do with them. Where I'm from, there's a 17-year cicada emergence, and they apparently taste like pineapple, and there are still enough people who've been around from the last ones who know how to deep fry them or do whatever it is. Chris Peters, who's at Tufts, has done some really interesting work trying to map food sheds and how much land would be necessary to feed people in various urban areas. And there's a team here that's been trying to replicate that for Minnesota, although the primary work was done for New York City. And in a lot of places, especially hilly places, that are going to experience a lot of erosion if they try to be farmed for crops, they argue that there are places, for example, for dairy, where you can get the conversion of grass into food in a way that then returns nutrients into the cycle if it's done well.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm talking about food supply sustainability with Emily Cassidy and Valentine Kedju. Now, what about the idea of buying local? Basically, the nearer the food is produced to you, the less energy you have to expend by bringing it to you. Does that work?
I think it's all about what you value. If you're eating locally because you value a connection to the land and the climate and the farmers that are around you, eating locally will achieve that goal. But like you said, a lot of the time, local eating is thought to be an environmental optimum. That if we eat locally, the energy expenditure for the transportation is going to be low, and therefore it's better for the environment and less greenhouse gas emissions. But what studies actually find is that when you look at, you know, all of the energy and the inputs and the greenhouse gases that go into producing the food that you eat, transportation is actually a very, very small fraction of that. It's less than 10% of all of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with your food is transportation related and even processing related. So when we talk about local eating, we have to think more about not just where it came from, but how it was produced and how it's shipped even. If you're eating something because it comes from northern Minnesota and it's on a truck from northern Minnesota to southern Minnesota, that might take more energy than if Walmart is shipping it large scale, you know, a large scale shipping operation, your greenhouse gas emissions per product might actually be lower than a smaller scale farmer, you know. And I'm sure that Valentine can comment on the fact that local eating is about more than just the environment, but we need to be sure when we're talking about these things that we're actually thinking about the right variables, that it might not actually be an environmental optimum to eat locally.
This is one of my favorite questions. I've done a lot of work on what local food means to people over the last decade. And I think that it's a really good example of where we need to try a little harder to carry on the kinds of conversations we have about food in more exploratory kinds of ways. Because for most people, local, as Emily said, means all these things about having relationships with farmers, and you want to support them, and you want to support the ability to have farming in your region, which both ecologically and politically makes a tremendous amount of sense. My favorite conference is the Canadian Association of Food Studies. Local foods and food sovereignty in the Canadian context is much more visible, for example, than it is in the US, mm-hmm. where there's an idea that you may not necessarily always be able to count on friendly neighbors getting you all the foods you want under political conditions that you're okay with. So there's, I think, more political will to maintain local food and agricultural systems. But that whole idea of the politics and the social relationships really end up getting kind of muted underneath the symbolic of how many miles did this travel, which, as Emily said, is often, by and large, from a transportation perspective, irrelevant. People's refrigerators use a lot more energy often. But it's not a trivial thing to have food and agriculture capacity, both for the knowledge and the ability to learn what elders knew and to be able to pass it on and experiment with things in your climate, and particularly as your climate changes and under the conditions you have. And also with the idea that if you can keep food production front and center and have it be something that's meaningful and that people participate in, maybe it doesn't accumulate quite as many of the abuses that happen when it's out of sight and out of mind and people feel sort of vaguely guilty about it, but they don't really know how to engage it.
Well, on a show like this, we do have to mention technology and genetic modification specifically. Now, that definitely has the potential to help us meet our needs, but it is very, very controversial. Now, we have talked about this on the show before, and invariably, the scientists tell me that the only real controversy is in the media and in the public, but not with the science itself. So it's your turn. Science says GMOs are safe. Is that your perspective?
I find this question of genetic modification fascinating. And there's been recently, I'm not thinking of her name now, a very impressive student in Canadian context who was interrogated on television somewhat unfairly. And it was a really good portrait of the way in which this conversation ends up being about this question of, can we feed the world? Can we have greater yields?
Right.
And she kept trying to point out quite articulately that we don't really have much demonstration that that's what genetic modification is doing, that there is a potential for things like drought tolerance and salinity tolerance and things that would actually be helpful, but that most genetic modification so far has been for glyphosate resistance, which is now being a trait that is being conferred to the very weeds that were being glyphosated. So it's kind of, I think, a really good portrait of the technology treadmill that farmers end up getting stuck on, in which they have to jump on in order to be able to compete with their neighbors and keep their farms. But it doesn't usually provide them with a higher income. If anything, if you get yield increases, it means it drops the price of a commodity so that people have to produce more of it. So they're working harder, putting more in, getting less. And this is one of the ways we see concentration as people get pressed out of farming and some farmers get bigger. There's been a wonderful thought experiment. Glenn Stone at Washington University has basically said, what if we took the controversy about this into very specifically the idea that the problem many people have, one of the most substantive problems, is that whatever the potential for genetic modification, one of the reasons it hasn't been realized is that it's mostly in a profit-driven system of seed control. And what if you had a genetically modified plant that was expressly designed to help feed people rather than to capture profits for the manufacturers of the seeds or the manufacturers of the inputs that go along with these seeds? As close as he's come to that is genetically modified manioc root, I believe. It's some sort of, or maybe it's a cassava, where it's vegetatively propagated. So it's from cuttings. So you couldn't own the seed. It wouldn't matter the question of whether you could buy seeds. You could just take cuttings and put them in the ground. It doesn't come ripe all at once. So it's not subject to state capture or to taxation at a specific time. It's not subject to warring in terms of people coming and, you know, burning your fields as much because it has underground tubers that can be stored underground. So it's really kind of like a people's plant. And if we started from there, I think we could have much more productive conversations about what genetic modification could do and the distance between where we are now and what it could potentially do.
You know, back on this point of trying to improve livelihoods with genetically modified crops, we have an example of that with golden rice. It's basically this strain of GM rice that added vitamin A to the rice. In a lot of developing countries, especially places like Southeast Asia, there's a vitamin A deficiency. And so a lot of people, when golden rice was first produced, I think it was like 10 years ago or more, they thought that this strain of rice would go on the market. But because we had this staunch people have anti-GM feelings and opinions for different reasons, and some of them are valid and some of them aren't. But because we had this anti-GM feeling that golden rice is only just now starting to become a viable option for people in Southeast Asia. And so I saw an article recently that said our reluctance to opt into golden rice has actually cost us hundreds of millions of lives. If you look at the people that have died from vitamin A deficiency between the time that we developed this crop to now, that's hundreds of millions of people that we could have essentially saved their lives. I'm not saying that GM is always good. I just think that we need to base our understanding of these things on science and less on feelings. And I think that a lot of this debate is a lot to do with sort of personal convictions. And more research is always needed. I don't think it's safe to say that all GM crops are always going to be safe. But from what we know right now, we're finding that GM crops are safe and have been safe. So I think it's important to keep that in mind, that we could actually make some pretty big steps in the right direction for human health if we relied more on the science, I think.
Well, then I'm going to put a plug in here for the integration of social sciences and humanities in with agricultural and food sciences, which is something particularly the land grants in the United States have been slow to do, although food studies programs are starting, I think, to help bring more of a systems perspective. Because one of the significant complications with a product like golden rice is intellectual property rights. Rachel Sherman at the University of Minnesota has been on a large project about humanitarian feeding efforts, and recently wrote a paper for the Yale Agrarian Studies program that I found fascinating. I had followed the story in the press, and this is the story you often hear about the fact that it's anti-GMO activism, and her earlier work was on the relationship between anti-GMO activists and gene technology scientists. And part of the story that she's uncovering is that something like golden rice is encumbered with 90 different intellectual property rights claims. And there's a effort that Gates and Rockefeller and some of the other large foundations are trying to spearhead, basically extracting some of these food products out from the patents that have been claimed on them. Because a lot of seed technology companies have basically filed intellectual property claims in every possible country they could, whether or not they're using those traits in those countries, making it almost impossible to release anything for humanitarian uses. And at the same time, one of the arguments that's not really an anti-GM argument, is kind of more a food security and food sovereignty argument, is that there's something kind of dire about the idea that it would be one additive in the one food that people can afford that would save them, rather than the ability of getting people to be able to access a more balanced diet and to be able to eat vegetables and things that have vitamin A in them. And I'm pretty sympathetic to this argument that we need to think about why it is that people are hungry. And particularly in rice-producing countries, these would be some of the places where people who are hungry are really recently pushed off the land, who were able to be self-sufficient until recently, even if not necessarily, you know, well-fed. There were systems in place for subsistence that have been removed from a lot of people.
This is Science for the People, and we'll be back to talk more about food sustainability after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and we're talking about food sustainability with Emily Cassidy, who studies the environmental impacts of global agriculture, and Valentine Kedju, who studies the cultural geography and social organization of land use and food governance. Now, I guess I should tell everybody that the idea for this show arose at Convergence, and that's a fan convention in Minneapolis, and the Skeptic Blog Network actually holds a science and skepticism track. And the two of you were on a panel on food sustainability that I moderated. And Valentine, one of the concepts that you brought up on the panel was the idea that our identities are very closely tied to our relationship with food. So I was going to talk to you about that, but during the break, Emily had a fantastic question for you, so we'll just start out with hers.
So I was going to ask Valentine about the idea of bringing a more balanced diet to different populations, and we mentioned India consuming a lot of rice, and maybe we should think less about incorporating golden rice into a diet and think more about introducing a more balanced diet into certain countries. But I was going to ask the question, the kinds of diets that people eat has a lot of cultural context, and that's also within sort of an economic context of rice being extremely cheap to produce and consume. So whether or not we can ask people to eat a more balanced diet when it's cheaper and also part of their culture to eat a lot of rice.
Rice is really interesting because it's kind of a middle-of-the-road food. In many places, and China would be a really significant example, as would a lot of Africa, rice ends up being a food that's something that's urban, especially polished rice, that you get to eat when you move up in the class structure. So in places where people ate what are often called coarse grains, like millet and sorghum and other grains that are easier to prepare, they don't require as much energy input and polishing, and are inherently more diverse just because there are more of them often, and they're often indigenous to these places or have adapted to these places, there have been really good demonstrations of increased food security. And Bill Moseley here at McAllister has been doing really interesting work with a group of colleagues around Mali and other West African countries in the recent food crises. And Mali, being a landlocked country, has a rice production agriculture that has actually been less disrupted than its coastal neighbors by the importing of broken rice from Asian large rice producers. And part of what that import has created is the ability for people to buy rice cheaply, especially urban laborers, without necessarily having a local supply. And this goes back to this question of why is local food important more substantively than that it makes us feel less guilty about our environmental or social impact? And when rice and food prices in general skyrocketed, the places that had significant existing production were much better buffered against those skyrocketing prices. So it isn't so much that it costs a lot to transport it, it's that globally traded commodities are much more volatile often than markets that are smaller and that have less financialization messing with them. Another really interesting aspect of rice, particularly, and this generalizes to a lot of crops, but rice is such a focus of agricultural development projects, is that in many places, growing rice was a project and a labor that was largely done by women. And a lot of development projects coming in from somewhat patriarchal cultures often concentrated on teaching men new agricultural techniques and improving men's agriculture. And you still see this. I saw an article very recently in The Guardian that had this very surprised sounding tone about how many women showed up to agricultural workshops. And it's this kind of amazing mismatch in the ideas we have about, I think in North America, we have a very male white idea of who farmers are. And the historical fact that most of the agricultural production for feeding people, particularly in the world, has been and still is done by women. So this idea of the identities people have and the identities that are more or less visible depending on the culture you bring with you is something I find really interesting about food cultures.
Well, and doesn't that lead to a bit of difficulty discussing these kinds of issues?
Absolutely. For one thing, we have a metaphor we so often use about who's at the table, which in food conversations is so salient. And because the food system is so complicated and there's so many parts to it, we almost never are going to have everyone at the table. We need to make sure we're going around to diverse tables and exploring the nooks and crannies of the food system, where we might discover that there's all sorts of food going on and being produced in different ways than we realize. The sort of grandfather of agrarian studies in the United States is Jim Scott at the Agrarian Studies Program at Yale. And one of his most famous books is called Seeing Like a State. And he has this idea that particularly technocratic science, and we are all somewhat guilty of technocratic science, especially at land-grant universities, has this problem that we look at the kinds of data sets that states collect, so things that can be taxed, large businesses, research and businesses that are in good terms with the state, that are often related in some ways to the funders for the research, whether it be the Gates Foundation or a large agribusiness corporation. And it really blinds us to a lot of the secondary markets, food that's being grown in people's backyards, foods that's being grown in slums around the world. There's the economic anthropologist Rick Wilk was at a seminar we did on how we talk about feeding the world at the Institute for Advanced Study here, and was pointing out that from the number of people in the world who are not included in the primary circuits of food, so the kind of retail sectors that we know about in grocery stores and the supply chains that feed grocery stores, there are at least half of the world's population now that live in informal settlements or outside cities who don't have access to those, that are getting food somewhere. So rather than how do we feed the world, he was suggesting we need to ask the question, how is the world feeding itself? That seminar also had another wonderful correction that I would really like to get out into circulation. There's a giant billboard that's used for promotion around the University of Minnesota, and it makes a great point about the wheat rust research that goes on here. But it says the next global famine will be stopped in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it started a big debate saying, well, when was the last global famine? And then people said, well, it depends how you define global and it depends how you define famine. But they basically came to a consensus after about a half hour of debating this that we really need to call them global outbreaks of poverty.
Now, Emily, all of the research that you've been working on, there's definitely a socioeconomic aspect to that as well, correct?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of research into meat consumption and how basically as people get wealthier, they change their diet from one that is more basic, includes more rice and other, you know, staple grains and roots, to one that consists more, you know, it's a more American diet. There's more meat and dairy in people's diets as they get wealthier. Even in India, where beef consumption is still mostly forbidden, meat consumption is increasing there because not eating meat is seen as sort of an old way of thinking. That's the way that our parents or our grandparents used to think about food. But, you know, the new generation is eating more meat. And this is the case in India and also especially China, where meat production is now more than twice that of the United States. So when we're thinking about being able to feed the world in 2050, it's actually less how we're going to feed 9 billion people and more how are we going to feed 5 billion meat eaters, because globally we're developing this middle class of people that is consuming more animal products. And by 2050, estimates are that the global middle class will be about 4 billion people. And that's a lot of people that we need to feed these very animal-dense, very energy-intensive diets.
In terms of your research, there must be politics and economics around even the idea of changing crop allocation.
Definitely. You know, and I think it's important sometimes for me to remember and not forget that agriculture is about more than just feeding people. I often fool myself into thinking that should be the primary focus of agriculture, which takes up such a huge area of land. It should be feeding the world. But, you know, especially here in the U.S., 2/3 of what we grow, it's about producing meat and leather and dairy and increasingly corn ethanol that's being subsidized by the government, that renewable fuel standard is demanding that we allocate more and more of our land to producing fuels. In my paper, I advocate that we start thinking more about feeding people with the land that we have, but there's a lot of economic and political obstacles to producing more food and less trying to produce more corn ethanol.
One of my preoccupations over the last several years has been this idea of neo-agrarianism that we see culturally, particularly in Canada and the US and the EU. We romanticize farmers. We really think that a rural lifestyle has a lot of benefits. And we see a lot of people as they come into that, you know, what we might think of from a food choice standpoint, being a meat-eating middle class, also choosing to move out of cities and to try their hand at producing food or to start being more significantly involved in farmers market kind of or direct consumptions and community supported agriculture. And so I'm kind of curious from a thought experiment perspective, partly because I just saw these staggering statistics at this agroecology summit on the demography of the way in which 20 and 30 year olds in the US at least are moving much more into rural areas than they have in previous decades. And I'm curious if there's a top end, you know, you see increasing meat consumption as people gain more disposable income, but does that drop again as a proportion as people gain more and are able to buy, for example, organic or locally produced meat, but it's more expensive? Do they consume less or are they just kind of paying more to assuage guilt and eating more?
I do think that it is sort of a logistical growth. So it's not that it continues forever, but that it levels off. You know, there's only so much meat that you can eat in a day. So I think that we're actually seeing that right now in the United States. People are talking about sort of peak meat, that we're actually leveling off our meat consumption, that actually meat consumption in the U.S. is decreasing slightly because of people's concerns about the health implications of red meat consumption. So there is some leveling off there, but you know, within a global context, we have a long way to go before everyone has the per capita income of the United States. But I think that that is interesting, people moving out towards more rural landscapes, because that's certainly not, you know, we're more of an urban globe than we ever have been. The world now is more urban than it is rural for the first time in history. So I think that people wanting to get back to the land is unique. And I do think that we definitely romanticize farmers, that we often think about being close to the land as a good thing. And people struggle over, should we have more people that farm? Is that a good thing? But in history, we've seen that as we get wealthier and as we get more efficient, or, you know, individual farmers are able to produce more food, there's less farmers and there's less of a economy for people being farmers. And so I think that people often think that that's a bad thing because we're less tied to the land. But as an academic, I can't help but think, well, this is also a good thing, because without us having more agricultural production per farmer, we wouldn't have a lot of opportunity to have other industries like academia. And so I think that although we think farming is romantic and we should go back to the old ways, that it's not going to happen, and it's not the trend that we've been seeing in history.
Well, and it seems like I've been reading David Friedman's controversial Atlantic cover story on how junk food can end obesity. Although he argues that he is a foodie, he's very hard on people who he thinks are romanticizing the possibility of people adopting a more whole foods kind of diet. But he, as he made this argument for the inevitability of more processed foods, and then I was hearing this demographer who was saying that we hear this argument about the inevitability, for example, of more industrialized lifestyle and more urban lifestyle, but that in fact, a tremendous amount of that is rural land being rezoned as urban. So it's not even people moving or changing lifestyles. It's people living in a place that becomes urban around them. And especially being situated here in the upper Midwest, where it's a very undense settlement pattern, people who live really up until the downtowns of city have a lot of access to land and are very politically active in trying to preserve more access to land that can be used to grow food. It seems like that's an interesting conversation to be having in a lot of cities that have increasingly over-urbanization, people moving from the countryside and sort of moving away from the ability to have access to land. But if there was the ability to have any kind of return to urban agriculture, which was practiced in many cities until it was necessary from a labor perspective to cut people's access to free food off, or, you know, food of their own labor so that they would have to produce wages.
So taking all of this into account then, these various disparate factors, how do we best meet our food demands over the long term then?
It seems to me that one of the places we really need to start looking more vigorously is places that are practicing successful agroecologies. People have lived in environments and produced food from them for thousands of years. And although we've been able to produce more with our high input, high output agriculture, often the cost of that is a high number of externalities in terms of pesticides in the water, soil erosion, loss of rural society and livelihoods, farmer suicides. Whereas there are, at the same time, indigenous methods, methods that have been used in places like Kenya, for example, of combining really intensive composting, like very high-tech, low-tech. So you're composting, you're planting sticky plants next to corn crops, next to smelly plants so that bugs fly away from the smelly plants into the sticky plants and get trapped there. So you end up with effectively a much lower input but still really high-yielding system. By trying to mimic and work with the complexity of the ecosystems, these agricultures have much lower impact, but they are really often much more labor-intensive. But we have a lot of people who need meaningful work.
Emily, now you were actually the co-author of the 2011 publication Solutions for a Cultivated Planet, and you described strategies to improve global food availability while simultaneously reducing environmental impacts. Maybe you could go over some of those.
One of them is looking at agricultural inputs. So if you look at places in the world where we're over-fertilizing and you compare those to places in the world that are under-fertilizing, there was a paper out recently by Nathan Mueller in our lab who looks at if we just shifted the fertilizer from these places that are over-fertilizing to places in Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe, where, you know, some more input is needed, we could dramatically increase food production. So thinking about not just increasing production, but also looking at places that really need to increase yields, as we call it, closing the yield gap, looking at places where we could be producing so much more food. And in these areas, they're probably more likely to depend more on agriculture for their income as well, that if we shifted some of the investments, the money, the time, the energy that we put into more developed agricultural systems, and we shifted that towards African nations or Asian nations or places in South America, we could radically increase food production and also reduce environmental impact. But, you know, I think that we do need to think about diets in general and how we're using the crops that we grow. One really scary statistic that I found doing my lit review for a paper that I recently published is by 2050, if we want to feed 9 billion people a Western diet, even using Western technologies, meaning very high input agriculture, we would still need twice the land currently under cultivation. And so when you look at where would that land be coming from, it's mostly places like, you know, the tropics in Brazil, rainforests in Indonesia and Malaysia, and places where expanding agriculture into those areas comes at tremendous ecological cost, not just, you know, carbon emissions from slash and burn, but also, you know, a rich diversity of endemic species, you know, that aren't found anywhere else in the world that we're just eradicating. I think that trying to use the land that we currently have under cultivation, with the caveat that obviously we need to try to improve the incomes and the livelihoods of people that depend heavily on agriculture in developing countries, because most people in developing countries depend on agriculture so much for their income. You know, there are many different strategies, but I think a big strategy is thinking about how people are changing diets and also how can we improve the livelihoods of people that are likely to want to expand into the rainforest in order to feed themselves.
So how could we impact something like that? Because that sounds more like a large-scale strategy. So as individuals, can we impact that?
I think sometimes when people like us say that we need to improve the livelihood of small-scale farmers, it sounds like we're just being bleeding-heart lefties and that we think this merely for the good of these farmers. But I think when we think about the global food supply and people's health and equitable access to healthy food, I think that it's easy to overlook how much, even in really wealthy countries like the US and Canada, the difficulty of making a livelihood as a farmer is part of what pushes farmers to growing crops that end up being either really high impact or not very healthy for people. And they end up being price takers for food processors whose major mode, because it's what they do, is to try to sell things that taste good to people. They're not really in it to make people healthy. I'm in the middle of trying to analyze data from several hundred farmer interviews and surveys that were done this summer. There's so many people out there basically volunteering to, you know, working at other jobs to subsidize their ability to feed people healthy food. People really find farming a meaningful job in places where they can actually make a livelihood at it. And I think that we ignore that at our peril. I also think from a kind of information people perspective, the idea that we need to organize and be much more strategic about the way we pressure governments to ensure the right to food and to ensure the right to healthy food, it's really been made an individual, I can vote with my fork. And that doesn't work. We have been trying that for decades, and we get small shifts, but you can see what happens. We have, I mean, the vast majority of the organic foods market, and I'm using organic with scare quotes here, is in junk food. And I think that we really need to cultivate a slightly more accountable and rigorous conversation about these things. On one hand, I think a lot of the scare language about land and agriculture, although I totally agree that it's a big problem, but a lot of it is rhetoric that's being put out there to get people to invest in agricultural land. And there's a lot of capital flying into agriculture right now because it seems like something people will need. And the more you can make it something that's they will desperately need, the better investment, it seems. It also seems like people want to do the right thing, but it's too complicated. So we need to get conversations where people can respect each other and explore these things. So say, yeah, all of this breeding that's been done, all of this technological improvement, amazing stuff. We're so grateful for it, but we need to keep going. And instead, I think for whatever reason, our mode is to say, hey, you suck. You know, we don't like you, or you're on the pollen side and we're on the side of progress. And that kind of division into us and them is really not the kind of strategic collective action we need.
Emily Cassidy and Valentine Kedju, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us. It was a great chance to talk.
You can find links to Valentine Kedju and Emily Cassidy on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be back to speak with Danielle M. Lee right after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, Rochelle Saunders spends the hour discussing the disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear reactor. She'll examine the impacts on the environment, public health, and the reputation of nuclear power with Dr. Charles Ferguson, president of the Federation of American Scientists and former project director of the Independent Task Force on U.S. Nuclear Weapons Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Rob Tarswell, creator of the 1 Minute Medical School video series. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
One last thing we wanted to talk about today on Science for the People. I'm here with Danielle N. Lee, a biologist who began blogging about science and science education as a way to engage African American and urban audiences in science, technology, engineering, and math. She blogs at The Urban Scientist at scientificamerican.com. Thanks for being here, Danielle.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so something happened last week on your blog, and
yes.
we thought here at the show that it definitely deserved a signal boost. So can you walk us through it?
It started with an email I got from an editor of another science network that I had never heard of before, asking me if I would write. It sounded spammy, but it was like the second correspondence I got, and so I finally responded. And was like, well, tell me the conditions. And I did make a point to go, and what do you pay? He responded. He was like, we would like something monthly, but we don't pay. Even Dr. Fancy Pants doesn't get anything. And so, you know, we were hoping you would be happy to do it for exposure. And I wrote three quick little lines. Thank you for replying. I cannot accept this offer. Have a nice day. That was it.
Hmm.
And the next response I got from him was, because we don't pay for blog posts, are you an urban scientist or an urban whore? And that's when I sat up, responded in nearly all caps, did you just call me a whore?
So just to reiterate, you had never heard of Biology Online. You
were never.
Not acquainted with the person emailing you. And when you declined to write for them, they basically called you a prostitute.
Yeah, call me out my name. Just, yeah.
Okay, so next step, you posted about this experience on your blog. What happened to that post?
It disappeared. And what happened, I actually thought it was technical because I did prime the pump a little bit. I had tweeted about it. I was like, man, you know, I got called a whore today.
Oh.
And on Twitter, folks on Twitter were like, what? And I was like debating because I had things to do whether I would respond. And Ray from the JFK responded first. She did a simple little thing and I was like, okay, I will respond. I started writing and I was like, you know what? I need to just say what I have to say. And so I did a video and I posted the video with a few words. And a lot of people were reading it. It was getting a lot of traction. And someone told me, hey, you got a few typos. You need to fix it. And so while I was behind checking it, folks were saying they can't read it. And I was like, oh, it's because, you know, I'm updating it. And WordPress, God love them, whenever you have a video embedded and you update, then the video disappears. Then you always are going back and forth trying to make your video stay in whenever you make updates. So that's why I really hate updates. Fixing typos when I have an embed in WordPress. So I really thought that was it. And then folks kept saying it was down. I was like, no, it's just that. I did learn that it was taken down, but I didn't know why. And so I was still attributing it to technical issues.
So Scientific American pulled your post and
they
didn't warn you ahead of time at all.
No.
Okay. So what was their reasoning?
I didn't get an explanation until I talked to Mariette DeChristina on Saturday. She is the editor-in-chief of the entire magazine, Scientific American. She told me, I mean, just reiterating what she said in her first tweet as well as what was reported on BuzzFeed, that they thought it was too personal and it didn't really fit, you know, the blog, and it wasn't science enough.
I find that very interesting because I read scientificamerican.com a lot. And there are many posts that do not specifically fit in with the idea of discovering science.
And that was my defense. I'm a debater. I debated in college. I made what I thought was a good prima facie case. Like, listen, not only have I done it before and it's never been pulled, there are several other bloggers that have done it before that hadn't been pulled. And I told her, I was like, I hear your reasoning. I hear your explanation, but your explanation just doesn't jive.
And what is the relationship between Scientific American and Biology Online?
I had never heard of them. And I'm inclined to think that maybe she didn't know much about them either. What I understand is there was, you know, I don't know. Let me quit mine. I don't know.
That's fair.
I was going to say, I know this much. They don't give us content. And I don't think they get content from us. I have no idea. There's something they're listed on the partner page. I don't
right.
know what that means, but let me quit lying to you. I don't know.
Okay, so now Scientific American has responded publicly with a longer post than just a tweet.
Correct.
And your thoughts on that?
I appreciate that. I really, really do. That made me feel better because I needed an explanation of something. And I think that was the understanding. If it is really about legal issues, I understand it. I mean, I'm very no-nonsense. I'm very practical. I ain't got no money, so don't sue me. So I don't want to get sued. And I'm not doing anything deliberately to get myself or anyone else I'm associated with sued. So, yeah, if my slip's hanging, let me know. Absolutely. But I needed someone to tell me that.
Before it was pulled.
Well, before it was pulled, or so that something else can be put up there. So I guess looking back, hindsight, I think a better way to handle these issues, because legal issues are really real and they matter, if something gets pulled, put up one of those we're having technical difficulty pictures, you know, like from the TV. You know, so that it's just nothing.
Right, because that definitely came across to the Twitter sphere. Honestly, Twitter exploded with this issue yesterday. Science writers and science bloggers were all over it, which is how I heard about it. So, And they were overwhelmingly supportive of you. And so the issue was, it seemed as if you had been censured.
It certainly felt like that. I mean, I don't know anyone's intent. I can't judge intent. What you tell me, I can believe or not believe. And I'm a pretty open person. I can defend Judas with the best of them. So I am very, very benefit of the doubt kind of person. Intent aside, I can only tell you what I see. And it hurt. I mean, there's no other way to put it. It was like, so this, everybody else talks about personal stuff. And other people have had, what I saw were very, very comparable issues as far as being tangly legally. So what about my post? What alarm? What did I step in legally? Or, because that's the only thing I can think is like, I know plagiarism is bad. I know copyright infringement is bad. I know saying things about people is bad. So I got some basic understanding. So it's like, oh man, did I say something wrong? And then, and sadly, that's what colored folk do. When folks of color in a professional setting, when something goes down, we find ourselves nitpicking and replaying everything we did wrong, which that is something that I think is worth discussing too, because we do have this very, we're deliberately very self-reflective as to what we did and how could we avoid the trouble. And the hard conversation is sometimes we don't, and nobody wants to hear that part.
Well, and that's good advice, actually. That's an interesting thought. One of the, I guess I would say an unexpected side benefit of this awfulness is the video that you made in response to Biology Online that you posted. And of course, that was taken off as well. But one of the things that you did was give advice to other science writers. So maybe any brief words of wisdom that you'd like to pass on?
Understand that if this is seriously a craft for you, that your time is worth something, your energy is worth something. When I first started, one, I didn't know enough to know that charging was okay. And I didn't, even if I did know, I had no idea where to start metric wise. So I did I do some free stuff? Absolutely. Do I regret it? Not at all. No, at least negotiate for the best for you at that moment. If getting exposure is awesome with you, do that. But don't let anyone tell you that exposure is good enough for you. Don't sit back and look at yourself always being the labor and someone else always benefiting. At some point, you have to be shrewd. And it's perfectly okay to be shrewd.
Well, and the video is not very long, audience. So what we're going to do is we'll link to one of the many, many sites that decided to repost that video and the rest of your piece after it was taken down.
Thank you.
And we are out of time. And I just want to point out it's obviously atrocious that you or anyone else should have to deal with things like this. But we appreciate you making an issue out of it, because there were a lot of really interesting conversations about this online, and we approve of good conversation.
Thank you.
After we recorded, Scientific American decided to put back up Danielle's post and the editor at Biology Online responsible for that original email. According to ABC News, he appears to have been fired. You'll find links to Danielle and Lee on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, click the links to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and of course to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the weekly podcast and support us by leaving a hopefully glowing review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.
Every week on Science for the People, we take the latest in scientific progress and relate it to people, our friends, our families, our communities, and our society. And we give researchers, authors, and journalists the time to talk in depth about what matters to them. If you love science but aren't satisfied with sound bites, join us again next week for Science for the People on your local radio station or online anytime at scienceforthepeople.ca.